Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Ask the experts about free fitting on all our kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now, Beneath the Surface is the name of the book written by my next guest. It's a memoir that charts the life of one of Ireland's best-known GPs, from his formative years here in Ireland to moving to Africa with his wife, then back here again, where, of course, he has become renowned as one of the leading voices in mental health treatment and care. And I'm delighted to say that Dr. Harry Barry is here with me in the studio.
Thanks, Claire.
This is not our usual chat, Harry,
no,
is it?
No, Claire, this is completely different. This is where I lay bare my soul.
You lay bare your soul. You found writing the book difficult enough. Is that fair to say?
Very difficult, Claire. Brenda will tell you, I would regularly be in tears. Because, you know, we were going back over, you know, literally 50, 60 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, reading back through, say, some of the love letters and poems and talking to so many, you know, of my family and colleagues and friends and it was, and particularly I think I found it very difficult, I found it very emotional, parts to do with Brenda, parts to do with the children.
Your wife, Brenda, of course.
parts to do with Sister Kieran, do you know what mm-hmm. I mean? So these were, you know, people very special in my life, and there were so many people. And we literally could have put almost the same again into the book, do you know? It was very difficult to decide what would go in and what would go out.
Well, listen, we're going to go all the way back because I want to talk about your mother. I loved the sound of your mother. She sounded like she was great fun.
Oh, my mum was a character. She was. She loved to party.
But she had a difficult start,
didn't
she?
She had a very hard... I mean, I think, you know, I started that with, you know, I might never have been. And it really was so very touching. And my mother never told me. In all of the time. It was my granny told me.
About her fiancé.
About her fiancé. And what actually happened was, she was actually engaged to be married to, I suppose the equivalent of it, like a GP radiologist, I suppose. He was working with Noel Brown, and they were involved in the management of TB at the time, which was a terrible illness at the time. It was like a death sentence, you know, people were dying all over the place. And, you know, but she really was in love with this man. She was engaged to him. They had a wedding date picked, they had a house picked, you know, everything was done. And then on this particular night, she was minding the surgery for him, and he came back a little bit late, fell in the door because he was after being in a road traffic accident on the motorbike. And, she, you know, my mother brought him up to the matter, and when they x-rayed him, he was riddled with TB. And, you know, like this, neither of them were aware of this at all. And then he was whisked off to a sanatorium. My mother was found to have some TB as well. And this poor man, absolutely, he loved the ground, my mother stood. And he actually broke out of the sanatorium to come to the house. And my granny wouldn't let him in. Because
tragedy of that.
It was, just think of the tragedy. And there's an extraordinary story. I won't reveal the tell, do you know what I mean? The thing, because later in the story, but where he ended up with this man, and he was given streptomycin, it didn't work, do you know what I mean? And he eventually died.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother, actually, she was bereft. She spent several years coming home, going to her room, crying, you know, really, absolutely torn apart by grief.
Did she ever talk to you about that?
Never.
It was your grandmother.
No, it was very much and that era, you know, where you just didn't talk about anything. Mm-hmm. And like my father never talked about, you know, the deaths that hit him. My mother never talked. My mother was so, there was so much tragedy in her life. She'd lost her father when she was only 13, I think. She lost her brother. She lost her sister. She lost her brother-in-law one by one. She even lost my brother David. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Who he loved very much at 49. But she was an extraordinary woman. Like she never complained. She would never talk about it. It was like as if there was an omerta. Do you know what I mean? You know, that was the era where you just pulled it all in.
You got on with
it. But it made it very difficult because my father was in the bank, and like the old College Green, literally across the road from the Bank of Ireland. That's where they met, and he was doing, I think, relief work, and my mother came in and out to him, or my mother was there. She was I think secretary to one of the guys on top, and anyway they met anyway and. eventually, you know, romance came into the being.
And they got married.
And they got married.
Do you know, I felt when I was reading the story of your childhood, yeah. I felt very sorry for this little boy who was dragged all over the country.
It was terrible, you know.
Which was nobody's fault. I mean, it was the thing if you were a bank manager.
If you're
at the
a bank
time,
manager, you just
you went.
You went. They said you go there, you went there, and you uprooted your family. And I mean, I think we moved three times in Dundalk alone. I loved Dundalk. I was very happy there. That was probably the happiest period of my life. As a child, but then we were shunted down to Wexford, back to boarding school, which was a horrible experience. I still to this day am traumatized by what happened to me at boarding school, and you know we eventually ended up in Thurles. Do you know what I mean? My father, they kept shifting him around all the time for different reasons, and it was very difficult. I never felt I belonged anywhere.
Well, that's a theme through the book. You say that you're a bit of an outsider, and you think because you'd asthma as well, didn't you, when you were growing up?
Yes, I had quite severe asthma, and in those days there was no nebulizers, there was no inhalers, there was nothing. You got this awful Franol stuff, which I can still remember the taste of, and I remember getting very ill with what they called double pneumonia in those times, which is actually bronchopneumonia, I think, in retrospect. But in those days, I spent months in bed. Do you know what I mean? And I just read. I went into my head.
Yes.
And I think it gave me that great love of books that I literally escaped in my head, you know, and I've done that my whole life. But I think it meant that when I got to college, I was very alone. Do you know what I mean? I was the first person in my family to go to school or to go to college. It was a huge decision to go to do medicine, do you know what I mean? Which my father must have been blown away by, because he was complete business all the way.
Yes.
And all the rest of my family were into business. And it was very difficult. I arrived in Dublin. I was alone. I was very young. I was just barely 17. I felt completely lost. Mm-hmm. Like all the Dublin scene, they were all knew each other and they were all related. They were all
bit of a click.
Yeah, I was a tick up from the country. Do you know what I mean?
But then you met Brenda, of course.
That was what changed everything. I mean, I stayed in the wonderful 36, which is Mad Digs, which you can read all about. It's a crazy place. But you know, I had this lovely night when I met Brenda. And you know, I really owe it to the guy who I spent the 6 years with in Diggs, or 5 years in Diggs. And he said to me this, and I came home from the Great Library and I was tired. And he said, you know, there's a bit of a dance going on up, and or there's a bit of a concert going up in the Isle of Max. So the Isle of Max, those people who don't know, was called the Great Hall. That was the name of it. And that's where we did all our exams. But also they occasionally had concerts there. And a little dance, do you know what I mean? So literally he said, Jamie Stone is going to be there. And Jamie Stone was actually the name of a guy called Carl, who I knew earlier, do you know what I mean? So I said, all right, if Jamie's playing, I'll wander up. So I wandered up and I was just literally listening to music, and then I saw her.
And you didn't even change your jumper before you
I
went
did,
up.
I
you,
look, oh, Brett,
your holes in your elbows.
You really would want to listen. You'd want to read in the book the descriptions of my wife gave of this guy who literally came down from the mountains with holes in the oh my God, and two left feet. And, I think I'd brushed the hair. That's about as much as I'd managed to do.
But you got the date anyway.
But I got the date. It went up, but the lights went out. It was incredible there. I literally asked this girl out and the lights went out. And when the lights came back on, she was gone. And Murdoch was pulling at me saying, come on, time to go. I said, no, there was something about that girl. And there was. She was beautiful.
You gave chase, did you?
So I just gave chase and I found her. And she said, I never let her go ever since. But it was just this magical chemistry. Mm-hmm. You know, it was immediate. Do you know what I mean? I keep saying to everybody, either chemistry is either there or it's not. Goodness, it was there. Do you know?
And listen, the two of you then, soon after you got married, went off to Africa. Yeah. I mean, what an extraordinary adventure. But you did it, you say, out of a sense of service.
Yes, right. Service was very important to both of us at that. Like, it's hard to believe nowadays because the world is very much about me and, you know, but in those days, it was very much about other people. Do you know what I mean? So we both had this sense of, before we, you know, kind of get into our careers, that we would give what we could to those who were in need. So we were initially going to go to Peru, but that didn't work out so well because I'd have to repeat my exams in Spanish, and that wasn't a winner. So eventually we went to APSO, and they put us in contact with the medical missionaries, this wonderful organ. They were the most wonderful people. I mean, and the minute I went and visited them, I knew that was where we were going. So Africa was going to be. So Africa was just, I think I said in the book, I went out there as an idealistic young man, or young adult, and came back a man.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can't explain. I mean, when you go to Africa, all rules are off. Everything you know about is gone. It was like we were out in the middle of, the track stopped where we were. We were a hospital, about 120 beds. We're always about 140 or 150 in them. It was catering for a million people. They were like, I didn't put it in the book, but there was one man came in on a bicycle, 50 miles on a bicycle with a fractured femur.
Oh, my goodness.
That'll give you an idea. There was a lovely little woman with polio. She all her limbs were gone with polio. And she used to come in literally on her hands and knees from the village with the child on her back. Every day. I mean, the visit was extraordinary. So we saw the most extraordinary things.
Well, we should mention Sister Kieran at this point.
Sister Kieran.
Because she was hugely important.
Sister Kieran was an incredibly important person in my life. She was one of the most respected medical missionaries of all. She had started out the original first hospital in Tanzania. She was a marvellous nurse. She'd gone off, she learned Mandarin at the age of 50, went off to Taiwan and started up the same thing out there. So when she came back, I was so fortunate that she was in Kabanga. And when everybody else was talking about work, she was quietly doing the work. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of beautiful person.
Was it fair to say you were quite overwhelmed by what you were seeing?
Totally
cases like you've just described.
I was overwhelmed.
But she took you in hand.
The children were dying of kwashiorkor and malnutrition. I was blown away. So I'd love to read, Claire, if I could. I'll read it very quickly here if I can. I was really suffering from what I call toxic stress. Exhausted, burnt out. And she gave out to me, that we were never going to be able to change that. But here was the lines that changed my life.
Mm-hmm.
She said, your task is to focus completely on the person in front of you at that moment in time. You can't change the world, but you can listen to this person, empathize with their problem, and do your best to help them manage it. That's your role and will always be. It is in that one-to-one interaction that you'll find peace. To be there for another human being who's in crisis and who needs your assistance in whatever form it takes, that is your role.
And you find that hard to read even now.
I tear up every time.
She meant so much to you. Now, I just wanted to come to one point that really stood out to me in the book, where you realise, and this leads us to all the work you've done in mental health, that emotional distress rather than pure mental illness was often the precursor to such a drastic, tragic decision. And you're talking there about suicide. Yep. And that really forms the thesis of a lot of your work around mental health.
Yes.
Emotional distress.
Emotional distress. When I came back to Ireland, and I spent many, many years working as a GP, and I loved all the patients, and I have to say, most of them loved me. But it was very clear to me increasingly that we were missing completely. There was this big gap. We were all talking about mental illness. There were other people talking about mental health, but nobody was talking about emotion distress. And I remember it was Joan Freeman said to me, founder of Pieta House, very early on, she said, an awful lot of suicides are due to emotion distress. And I had already made up my own mind, do you know what I mean, that was the missing link. So emotional distress is all the things that happen to us in life and how we look at them. And it's those things that make us, you know, hurt or ashamed or guilty or depressed and so many of those things that actually lead people into darkness. Do you know what I mean? So very often, if you can find that, you can help them pull them back.
I think there's
the
a great
darkness,
comfort in that, I hope, for people.
Yes.
Now, you have brought an envelope in with you, and we know you're a wordsmith. This is book number 12. And Brenda, of course, is a hugely important part of your life. But you're going to take us back to 1975 now, am I right?
1975, 50 years ago. So I'm going to read a poem here. It was a love poem that I wrote for Brenda, but it's a poem that I want everybody to listen to. So whatever you're doing, I want you to put it away. I want you to shut down your busy mind and I want to listen with your heart. It's called Moments. Wispy glances, soft and timeless. Dreamy hours of time grown still. The gentle hush of a shadow eve and the loving softness of a woman's touch. The chorus of a thousand joy-filled hearts and the swirling magic of a ghost-like dew. Moments, precious, wondrous gifts, snatched from the clutching arms of time, free from the numbing cares of life, untouched by the ceaseless hum and the soulless, mindless chaos of a dreary, far-off world. Fleeting glimpses of elusive peace for the helpless victims of merciless fate. Drafts of air for dying embers.
Harry, thank you so much. And the book is called Beneath the Surface, a memoir. And right at the start of the programme, I said it's a very special book, and it truly is. And it reads so beautifully, and it's so interesting. It's a fascinating story. I'm waiting for you to do part two. But anyway, we'll get over this one first. Dr. Harry Barry, Beneath the Surface, a memoir, which is available now.